Okay. Now, I'll go back. You want to go, so you know how that looks like. If it goes over there, you might, this is your bottom, so you might want to turn it down a little bit and see if it's through your earphones, it's too loud, or if it goes over to the red and continues to stay there, it would mean you're doing too much walking. So you can adjust this. You won't need to worry about this until you're dictating, and somebody said, and he leaves here, and the tone you can adjust as you will. Now, I'll go over here and see. Can you hear me from here?
Yes.
Through the earphone?
Yes.
You're picking it up all right? From over here too? All right, is the volume control all right? I mean, you're... And it doesn't go over to the red. Unless you make a lot of noise like that, right? Then it goes over. Okay. Then it should be okay. Can you hear back in here? Well, I hear the typewriter.
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. I think you'll pick up everybody again, and I don't think there'll be any trouble. The only thing you'll have to remember is to close the doors, probably, because they'll make a lot of extra. Okay, now. Okay.
This is the Joint Special Committee on Special Responsibility, February 5th, 1973, in room 319, Chicago.
Call this first meeting of the Joint Special Committee on Professional Responsibilities together. We have, because it is our first meeting, a little bit of business, and if you open your book to the very first page, you'll see the committee rules. And if you would like to take a minute to read through them, why, we'll go ahead and adopt these. Thank you. Like to make a motion that we adopt the rules.
I move that we adopt the rules.
Senator Hurd moves that we adopt the proposed rules. And will the clerk call the roll, please? Shield law. We have three fields that we have been charged with. One is the shield law, the next would be the open meeting bill, and the third would be the legislative ethics. We have planned to take them in that order. Trying to find a meeting night has been rather hard for us, and so we have settled for the time being on every Monday at 7 until we get these things out. That's all right with everyone. There is a conflict, but we'll try and arrange a different time. Committee of Panel. We will be sharing the chairmanship and of the committee meetings, usually rotating weeks. And I lost on the flip of the coin, so tonight our chairman is going to be Representative Ingram.
Maybe you won on the flip of the coin. The President of the Senate wanted to give us a little send-off, but I don't believe he's here yet. And in order to save time, I'd like to explain two things. First, I'm going to ask those witnesses who are here from out of town to testify first on the belief that those other ones can come back and catch us at another date more conveniently than those who are from out of town. I would also like to advise you that if a witness has already made the same pitch you're going to make, if you just stand up and say, I agree more or less with a previous witness, it will save you time and the audience time and the committee time. And I'd like to call on Bob Davis as the first witness, because the bill we are considering tonight is known as the governor's bill. And from after Bob, we'll go to the out-of-town witness.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the bill referred to, one of the bills on this subject referred to this committee as Senate Bill 206, which, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, was drafted in the governor's office at the request of several members of the House and the Senate and members of the media. And I should point out that it's based substantially on the model law recently proposed by the American Newspaper Publishers Association. I've done considerable research in the area of shield laws. Attached to my copy of the statement which I'm about to give are the laws of the various states and the approaches adopted by the various states that have adopted some form of a shield law. It is my judgment, Mr. Chairman, would you like to interrupt at this time so that Senator Bowe could testify? And
just a minute, Bob. Jason, would you like to make your pitch before we go into the details of this bill?
Just barely started, Jason. Go ahead.
Sorry,
I'm
Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, it's not very often that that I'm forced to a decision in which highly prized rights seem so deeply in conflict as in the shield bills. I have spent the weekend examining the relevant data that is available and to which I will be referring you this evening, some of the resource material that I have been going over. And despite the fact that this committee is holding its first meeting tonight, we've all become familiar with the pro and con arguments, largely through the instrument of the press itself. It's appropriate that the guarantee to free speech is the very First Amendment to the United States Constitution, and I can think of no more important a right. Specifically, it says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And despite this original shield, some courts and grand juries have recently found a way clear to establish de facto abridgment of press freedom by driving a wedge of distrust between the reporter and his vital confidential sources. It is becoming almost a fad to hail reporters before courts and ask them to spill the beans on events their own investigators don't seem to have the talent to dig up. This subpoena is often accompanied by a threat of open-ended contempt sentence, which almost certainly would come under the category of cruel and unusual punishment. What I'm basically saying is this, that if the legislative branch doesn't have the authority to abridge press freedom, why should the judicial branch have it? No one treasures the constitutional guarantees of equal protection and due process of law more than I do or the members of this legislature. But in the past few months, I have searched and searched for ways to assure that courts are not denied the power to enforce these rights while at the same time preserving a completely free press. I have searched for ways to avoid the creation of a special class of citizens with special rights under law, but I think that search ended as I read the First Amendment for about the 30th time this week. The First Amendment itself takes note of a special class. It guarantees free speech for everyone, and then it singles out the press, and for good reason, I think. The press is special in that it is a check on government which is outside of government. It is a private interest supported by the citizenry and entrusted with supplying a multitude of viewpoints, all grounded in the media's own code of truth, fairness, and accuracy. That government will never be created which can provide that check itself. It is becoming more and more widely appreciated that this proposed legislation does not grant special protection to news people so much as it grants protection to the people's right to know. This becomes especially important when some officials seem to be responding to growing public mistrust of government by making their moats deeper and their bridges higher. I well understand the feeling of vulnerability that a public official may feel toward the press, the feeling that, if unjustly wronged by it, he has no recourse but to engage in a futile battle with it. I would like to read a quote from the historian Alexis de Tocqueville. He says, in this question, there is no medium between servitude and license. In order to enjoy the inestimable benefits that liberty of the press ensures, it is necessary to submit to the inevitable evils that it creates. Those of you who have followed my deliberations on this question are aware that I initially favored some form of qualified shield that could balance the First Amendment with the Fifth and the 14th Amendment guarantees. In researching and mulling over all sides and arguments on this issue, I have become much more favorably disposed towards a total shield, with, of course, the exception of libel. And I would encourage this committee to carefully study legislation along these lines, study which in turn will greatly enlighten all of us in making our final decision on this matter. I will be referring to this committee all bills on financial disclosure by public officials and lobbyists, all open meetings legislation, and legislation and any further bills on protection of the press and the public that may come before the Senate this session. I trust solutions on all these fronts will be forthcoming, and that together we can renew the trust that must exist between government and the people, between the news media and the people, and between the press and all public officials. You face a difficult and a sensitive task, and I'm extremely confident that your solutions will pave the way for this renewed trust, which is so vital to every one of us. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity of appearing before you tonight. John, do you have those two documents? And I'm sure Representative Ingalls probably is a subscriber to this one. This is the Columbia Journalism Review, which I've had the opportunity to study extensively this past weekend, the September and October of 1972 issue of it, in which I think the data in this volume is extremely important and well-written, well-presented. The other one that I'd like to refer to you for your study would be the 1971 supplement to the Mass Communication Law Journal, which also has an extremely good legal presentation of the various opinions that have been rendered by the courts and others on this matter of the shield. I look on the work of this committee with great envy. I envy the opportunity that you have to dig into this. And as I said, I have no there's no question that I've never been more torn, I don't believe, on an issue as I am this one, between how do you balance the First Amendment freedom of the press with the right of a person to defend himself through the due process of law on the Fifth and the 14th Amendment on the other hand. And I envy you, and I envy this committee, their work that they have in front of them on these issues, because it's substantial and it's substantive, and it's so important to all public officials and to the news media itself, but most of all, it's important to the public. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you or the committee may have.
Are there any questions of the Senate? If not, we appreciate your not taking the Fifth and your thoughts on the matter. Thanks very much, Senator.
I'll leave these with you, and you can get copies of them perhaps for the members.
Thank you, Bob, for your courtesy. I assume that a candidate for governor takes precedent over an acting governor.
You've got a vote. You can say that. I
want to flip that.
I will say that I agree wholeheartedly with the comments that were made by President Bowe, and I'd like to address myself to the two basic issues that it seems that every state that considers a shield law must address, the legislature must address itself to and solve. The question basically in a bill of this type is whether the reporters can refuse to answer questions about confidential sources they have cultivated, and whether this protection should be unqualified and unrestricted. I believe, as does Governor McCall, that the protection should be granted and that it should be unrestricted. This to ensure a continued free flow of information to the public. I think there's been entirely too much conversation about protecting the reporter. As a matter of fact, I don't think that's important here or really is at issue. What really is at issue is the right of the public to know, to have a free, unfettered flow of information to the public in order that they can fully understand the issues that are before them. And the fact that a reporter may go to jail under the current situation, it doesn't seem to me is important in the sense that the greater overriding public need is for the free flow of information. Now, the heart of Senate Bill 206 lies in Section 3, and it says that no person may be required to disclose the source of any published or unpublished information obtained by him in the course of gathering, receiving, or processing information for any medium of communication. This section, as I indicated, protects a person against disclosure of unpublished information and the source thereof. Now, one of the objections which are raised to this type of law indicate that it creates great difficulties for lawmakers and the courts who try to determine who a newspaper man is and who is not. Senate Bill 206 overcomes this objection by simply giving the protection to a person gathering, receiving, or processing information to dissemination to the public. Recently, the state of California adopted a new shield law, in fact, on December 28th. But in my opinion, it is not sufficiently broad. It is unqualified as to the material covered. And I think you have to make a distinction between an unqualified statute and an unrestricted one. Unqualified applies to the material that is covered, that is, the source of information. The restrictive is as to who is covered, who has the protection afforded by the statute, in other words, who is a newsman. Under the terms even of the most recent California legislation, Benjamin Franklin would have been protected, but Thomas Paine would not. Previous California legislation also was inadequate in that it did not offer protection to a magazine reporter, and this was determined in the case of in the application of Cepeda, the star first baseman for the New York Giants, who sued Look magazine and made a petition to the court to have a disclosure made of the sources of some information in connection with an article written about him for which he was suing. The court held that since the statute applied to newspapers, radio stations, and television stations, that Look magazine, being a periodical, that therefore someone gathering news for that periodical was not a newsman in the sense of the statute and therefore was not covered. Now, one of the things that we hear the most is that the legislation would allow libel and slander and defamation of character. This is not true. Under Senate Bill 206, it declares that the protection does not apply with respect to the content or source of defamatory information in civil actions for defamation. Consequently, anyone who feels that inaccurate information has been published about him has application to the court for compensation, and the shield provided by the statute does not apply. Now, it's possible that there would be untrue information published if this bill were adopted, but that is possible today. And I'm also sure that it's conceivable that abuses of law could occur if this bill is passed, and we could all sit here and conceive of types of situations in which abuses might occur. All I can say in that regard is that Pennsylvania and several other states have had unqualified laws of this type for over 30 years, and my research has been unable to detect any abuses of the law. And apparently there have not been any that have been very bad, or the laws would have been repealed. But I guess it should be pointed out at this point that even if this bill were passed, it's not written into the Constitution, and therefore it could be repealed in 2 years if the newsmen of the state suddenly become irresponsible and abuse the protection that's afforded. I think another significant thing about this is that Senate Bill 206 gives the right of confidentiality to the reporter, but it doesn't limit his right to testify. And in that sense, it's entirely different than the historical kinds of privileged communications that exist between lawyer and client, doctor and patient, priest and penitent. Because in those historical kinds of privileged communications, they cannot be disclosed without the permission of the informant. And so that would not be true in this situation, since the reporter could violate his journalistic ethics and could testify if he felt compelled to do so by some overriding public concern or the protection of the individual. Now, it seems to me that our concern here is not whether the media are occasionally careless. Our concern is not even whether a reporter may go to jail for a refusal to reveal his sources. The concern here is that the United States Supreme Court, in a recent decision, created an atmosphere in which the press will not be able to fulfill its duty to be a conduit for the free flow of information. Because in the case of the Caldwell case, the Supreme Court held in a very narrow 5-4 decision that the First Amendment did not provide a constitutional shield to news gatherers. Now, the court did point out clearly in that case that while it did not, in their judgment, fall within the First Amendment, even though there was serious discussion about it, that the Congress of the United States and the legislatures of the various states could, in fact, adopt this type of legislation should they feel it necessary. And at least, as I indicated, 18 states have already done so. And as I say, I have attached the copies of the various statutes to this statement. And I think you'll see in analyzing those statutes that there has been a tremendous variation in approaches taken. Some are totally unqualified. In fact, most of them are unqualified as to the no restriction on the right to refuse to disclose a source. Some have various qualifications on what is indicated as a newsman and who should be covered. I should point out that, in my judgment, I think when you start to defend, as they have in California and some other states, when you start to define a newsman, you create really more problems than you solve, because you stand the chance of course, excluding a reporter for Look magazine because it's a periodical. And I believe that it should be applied to anyone who is gathering news for the for dissemination to the public. Because the important thing here is to develop a confidence in the informant that he may have that the information and his name may be confidential. And if you start qualifying that privilege, you immediately erode the confidence that he has that it will not be disclosed. Now, district attorneys in this state have almost unanimously exercised good sense in asking reporters to testify or otherwise provide information about alleged crimes. But I think that we're seeing throughout the country a change in governmental attitudes which really concern me. I think we've began to see the use of, for example, of the grand jury as an investigatory device rather than one to protect the individual against indictment and trial on a specious charge. Originally, we thought of the grand jury as the right of an individual to go before a confidential body or to have a confidential body look at the prosecution's case and say whether or not that individual should be held for trial. But in recent years, we've seen both at the federal and at the state level more use of the grand jury in moving out into and investigating crime. And there are several things that concern me about that, and the fact that a person being investigated has no right to have a lawyer's advice and as he testifies before a grand jury. The district attorney there is there to cross-examine. And I think it can be a tremendously intimidating feature, even to someone as sophisticated as a reporter who has been engaged in the gathering of news. But the mere fact that an individual, a reporter, can be called before the grand jury also, of course, raises apprehension in his sources of information because they know not what he may tell a grand jury under the intimidation of the majesty and power of government. I won't go into the Caldwell case, but I think it can be read at length. I think that there are some very interesting statements made in that case, particularly in some of the dissenting opinions, in the four dissenting opinions. But as the intrusion of bigger and bigger government into the personal lives of people occurs, fear develops. And I think it leads many people to submit meekly to the dominance of government. I just don't believe that a free society and a democratic government can operate without the ability of the press to engage in in-depth investigation of the activities of government. And I think one of the things that raises it to mind the best was about 6 or 8 months ago, I was discussing with a Portland newswoman her problems in an in-depth investigation she was making of nursing homes in the state of Oregon. And one of the greatest difficulties she had in trying to obtain accurate information and accurate feelings of patients in the nursing homes was the fear of the elderly. that somehow their names might become public and that they would then become subject to abuse discrimination by nursing home operators or by the welfare department or whatever. Whether or not the fears of the elderly in this regard were justified, they were real fears in their mind. And as a result of this, it was very difficult for this reporter to get them to speak their minds because of this fear. Now, it seems to me that the media has the legal ability and the legal responsibility to investigate government. And this is particularly true in a time that we're seeing the greatest efforts within recent memory on the part of government to suppress criticism. A government need not be corrupt to be bad. It need not be stifling dissent so as to steal. For some in the bureaucracy, the reward is the power to manipulate other people's lives. And it seems also that that James Madison, who I'm sure no one would ever think was a flaming liberal, wrote correctly that a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives. Justice Douglas, in a dissent in the Cardwell case, said that effective self-government cannot succeed unless the people are immersed in a steady, robust, unimpeded, and uncensored flow of information and reporting, which are continuously subjected to critique, rebuttal, and reexamination. I have added a copy of the California decision, the California statute, which was passed, as I indicated, on December 28th. And I have attached to it, and will pass out to you, a press release from Governor Ronald Reagan at the time he commented on the unqualified statute, which was passed in California. And I agree entirely with the statement of Governor Reagan when he said, "I believe in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which guarantees the freedom of speech and press. The legislation I have signed today is in keeping with that amendment and strengthens the newsman's privilege. A free press is one of the country's major strengths, and the right to protect his source of information is fundamental to a newsman in meeting his full responsibilities to the public he serves." Of course, I would make these available to the members of the committee, but I think the point here is that we have people of such diverse governmental thinking as Justice Douglas of the U.S. Supreme Court and Governor Ronald Reagan of California, both agreeing that there should be the unqualified right to protect the newsman source in order that the free flow of information can continue to the public. And neither were trying to protect the newsman. Now, I think that we shouldn't be so much concerned about the source of information as we are about its accuracy. And of course, the accuracy can be tested, as I indicated, by court proceedings, at which point the reporter must bring forward his proof of accuracy and at that point make the decision as to whether or not to disclose the source. The President of the Senate talked about the problems he had in wrestling with the First Amendment to the Constitution and the right of people to be confronted by the accuser and so on. This happens quite often in the law, that we'll have both constitutional and statutory and common law rights which come in conflict. And at that point, a court or a legislature must decide which right is paramount, which right must give way to the other. And it seems to me that here, the people's right to know is paramount to any government's right to secrecy. I see no cause to believe that an untrammeled press will hinder law enforcement, but I see every reason to believe that a trammeled press will hinder society from reaching its goals. I think David Brinkley stated it best when he said that he's never seen a government taken over by the press, but there are instances in history in which the press have been taken over by government. Senate Bill 206, in my opinion, is clearly in the public interest. I urge that you give it your favorable recommendation for passage. Thank you for having me here, and I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions you might have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. We appreciate your comments. Are there questions? Ms. Davis.
Bob, I take it there's an underlying assumption that without a shield law, there is some destruction of the public right to know. Are there any instances you're aware of where the public should have had a right to know the source of the original charge or information? Where did Jack Anderson find out about the claimed drunkenness of Senator Eagleton? Where did they find out about the Watergate business? And where did they find out about the slush fund? Is there a trampling of the public right to know in a situation like that where there's a crime charge?
I think not. If in the instance of, let's take the Jack Anderson situation, for example, I don't recall whether he ever disclosed the source or not, because at the time of the denial by Senator Eagleton, he apparently rechecked his sources of information and said, I was wrong. Now, let's assume that he had said, no, Senator Eagleton, I'm right, and had been sued for this, because it obviously was clearly wrong. He would at that point have had to come up with that information which would have shown the accuracy of his information. Now, it seems to me the other question by some of the other situations are the question of whether or not knowing the source is as important as having the information itself. I really don't think so, because here we have government saying we must have the source of information, and yet the same government operating through its police departments and FBI and all of our other organizations, not only operate through confidential informants, but even paid ones who infiltrate these organizations and have, in my judgment, far more ability to do this than does the private or the public press. So it seems to me that the importance is the information, which the public would not have, in my judgment, in any other way. So it's more important to, say, have Watergate exposed than it is to know where the reporter got the information. Aggressive police agencies with paid informants might be able to find that out after the information was exposed. But again, the question is, was it right? Was the information correct or not? And obviously, much of it was.
Mr. Chairman, I had another question. Unfortunately, it's a little involved. Basically, I'm calling on you to defend further the definition of a person who is disclosing information or who won't disclose the information in Section 3. The section says no person shall be required by a legislative or executive or judicial officer to produce his source of information if he is collecting it to dispose of the information through any medium of communication. And then medium of communication is defined so that it's not limited to, there's a list of every medium of communication you can think of, and then the definition says it's not limited to that, so that any person who said he was going to disseminate the information would be covered by this definition, it seems to me. It is very different than the Pennsylvania law, which is limited to members of a newspaper staff or a press association compiling, editing, or publishing news, and it's different than Governor Reagan's lauded bill, which talks about a person employed on a newspaper, press association, or wire service, or a former employee, or radio station news reporter, or a television station news reporter, or a person employed by a radio or television station. That's a long explanation, but my point really is that everybody is collecting information to disclose by some medium of communication, unless he's a hermit.
Well, I don't think it's quite that broad, but it might be. What I am proposing, I think it's that it's restricted to those that who are gathering the information for dissemination to the public,
Really, it sounded like a statement that I made. What I'm after is more defense of this definition.
All right. I was indicating earlier, I think, that by some of the definitions that have occurred in some of what I call restrictive statutes, in that they limit, they try to define the newsman, you have a situation in which a Benjamin Franklin would have been covered and a Thomas Paine would not, because he was not writing for an established newspaper. As you go down through the attempts to define what a newsman really is, you'll find a variety of approaches from defining a newspaper being published for the last year, at least once a week, with a general circulation of X and so on. And I say that when you do that, the factual question of whether or not a person is raising or gathering information for dissemination to the public is much easier under a definition like this than it is an exclusive one such as these attempts to define. I think Nevada, for example, has one that is quite general and broad in its nature. And I suggest, because in California and several other states, they've said that the statute being in derogation of the common law will be strictly construed, that you create more problems by trying to define newsman than you do by having a broad definition. And of course, why not allow a Thomas Paine, even if he happens to have long hair and a beard and in sandals today, why not allow him to write and disseminate his information, even though it might not be the kind of writing with which you agree politically? I think that's what it's all about, really. And when you start making these kinds of qualifications, you really sort of get into trouble. And that's why the language is as it is. I don't find Nevada quickly, but my recollection is that's one of the most unqualified in the...
The way I read subsection 1 of 3 in conjunction with subsection 2, which defines medium of communication, it could cover a situation that you have a bureaucrat, a head of a state agency, required to publish a brochure, an information brochure to the public. And what it's drafted here, if that's true, then a legislative committee could inquire into the source of information.
Well, I'll say this, I certainly don't want to protect a bureaucrat, and if that's the language, we ought to change it.
I've just been sitting here reading it while I'm trying to say this stuff, but I don't see anything that's in there.
Yeah, well, if it comes medium of communication, is...
It's a pamphlet, and then you've just got person down here.
Yeah. Well, you could exclude the government agencies. If that is a serious concern, I think you could exclude governmental organizations.
What about quasi-ones?
Well, like what?
Utilities?
I don't think they should be covered.
Anything more, Molly? Ed, did you have another question?
The real problem is trying to be sure that you don't leave out any newsmen who are gathering news and disseminating news or opinion, and trying to be sure you don't leave any out. You fixed it so that you've included everybody in the state.
I don't read it quite that broadly.
How can I exclude someone? I write a newsletter once every 2 years, and during in between, I spend most of my time gathering information for it. Now, I may not print it all. I may not use all the information, but I do write a newsletter once or twice every 2 years. And it seems to me that almost everyone would qualify under the definition of a person gathering news by any medium of communication. I understand why it's written this way, but it just seems to me like it covers everybody in Oregon who can speak. I like Nevada better too. That's Pennsylvania, California, Nevada.
Yeah. Well, I really, I'd be very careful about being, in my judgment, and being very restrictive in trying to define the medium of communication to exclude those whose public attitudes or public utterances might not be in, you know, conformity with your own. That's why I'd even extend the protection to you, Senator.
The way the bill's drafted, you'd have to.
No. No, the law of libel and slander still applies.
Was this a judicial opinion you just rendered?
No, sir.
Does Bob Oliver have any response to that question?
Bob?
Well, I think when it comes to media communication, I suspect if this came up before a court, they would read Marshall's words, first of all, to get some idea of just what media they're talking about. And then they would take that definition and perhaps construe it in light of the enumeration in particular here, which are pretty much in turn things that most people commonly think of as the publications, books, newspapers, things of that sort. Only newsletters that they do irregularly and infrequently be a part of the medium of communication, arguably so, but on the other hand, most of the items enumerated here are continuous, ongoing expressions that are put out on a regular basis with some continuity, or that might be found in a state library. Not that legislative newsletters are not found in libraries, but they're not commonly thought of as part of the media of communication. Further, this is modified sub 3 here by the word to the, in section 3, by the word to the public. Well, would a newsletter to people in one particular district be to the public? I wouldn't say, Senator, that citing this definition is to be done.
I cover as much territory as the smallest radio station in my district, I'm sure of that. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. What bothers me is that on page 2, line 11, it says medium of communication includes, but is not limited to, and then it lists everything you can think of under media of communication. Mr. Oliver's suggestion is that a court will interpret the language as to bail us out, and of course it's the court interpretation that has us here tonight.
Mr. Hurd,
Bob, I thought Norma raised an interesting point, because one of the things that we came up with in the publication study and dealing with governmental bodies and so on is that there are many things that they deal with talking to the public. It seems to me on line 31, 33, and 34, with the medium of communication, so I'm checking the definition on lines 11, 12, 13, and 14. That already we've started defining, and then going along with what Norma said, but it's not limited to, and we start talking about government bodies, quasi-government bodies, and so on. We're already writing a definition.
Well, I don't disagree that we are writing a definition. I'm saying that I think it is as broad as it can be. I would tend to agree with Mr. Oliver that I can't imagine a court strictly construing a statute of this type, applying it to a governmental agency or even an elected official who might be issuing press releases. But it should, you've got to take these words in their normal context as to what medium of communication means. And it's when you list newspaper, magazine, other periodical, pamphlet, news service, wire service, news featured syndicate, broadcast station, or network, or cable TV station. It seems to me that you're pretty well indicating the type of thing that you're talking about, but I guess the argument is not limited to is the question that may open the door, and I'm quite willing to accept a change in wording that does not exclude the pamphleteer, does not exclude the person who the Thomas Paine of today, but does exclude the politician, the bureaucrat, the public official, the rest of it, because I mean, this is what it's all about. We've got to open up government, and you're going to hear another bill in that connection. But this is the whole purpose here is not to protect the reporters, but to open up those means of communication. So I guess what I'm urging is that any language which would exclude the things we're worried about here be very carefully drawn so that it doesn't exclude even illegitimate, if you will, press.
Senator Carson?
Mr. Chairman, take us off the point for a moment. I know you have a penchant on legalese and jargon. May I ask the witness what outtakes mean?
What who?
What outtakes mean, line 22, where it's a problem. I'm struggling with your language. Sorry, Bob, I didn't mean that.
Oh, there's no problem with that at all.
The whole list of questions they have.
Yeah, right. That has something to do with computers, I think. You understand that.
It doesn't mean quoting out of context, does it? Outfit.
Appreciate that.
Are there any more questions of Mr. Davis? One thing. Mr. Davis, briefly, why is a unqualified Shia law, in your opinion, better than one that says the reporter must be given a source if a court of appeals asks him to?
Because the mere threat to the source of information that the reporter can be called before a court or a grand jury and subjected to a court decision as to whether or not his name will be revealed removes the confidentiality of the relationship. And in a very interesting article, which I could supply to the committee, in the Michigan Law Review, there was a study made nationwide by this writer, which indicated that the mere threat of a subpoena in another state of a reporter to disclose information caused sources of information to dry up in another state because people were afraid. This is what's wrong with the present situation. The Supreme Court decision has caused this dry up of information. So the mere threat of doing it, and that he doesn't know as a reporter or as an individual that confidentiality will be protected, because it's subject to court decision, dries up the source of information. And if we're really interested in the information rather than the protection of the reporter, we have to have an unqualified statute to make it work.
You said a couple of times the government's right to secrecy. Can you envision any time that the private individual would have a right to secrecy under these circumstances?
I don't think I quite...
Well, you referred a couple of times to the government doesn't have this right of secrecy, that the press should be able to go in and discover what they want to keep undercover and so forth. What about an individual? Is there anything that maybe an individual should not have this right of secrecy at any time?
Well, of course, we have constitutional protections against self-incrimination and the other aspects of the protection of the individual. So, certainly, government is entitled to investigate through the police force the commission of crime, and should, and does. and of course does exactly with complete immunity what we're proposing here in the outgrowth and the recent development of these interagency narcotics units, which employ paid informants to infiltrate the counterculture and, you know, obtain information. And very seldom are the informants' names ever disclosed. And the government makes that decision itself. If it gets to the point that the case requires the disclosure of an informant, they can dismiss the case, and frequently do. So I think that the reporter might have that same kind of protection.
Are there any more? Yes.
That's not based on statute, though. That's based on a position of power, which may not be fair, but there's no statute that says if you're working for Lynn and you're called before the grand jury, you can refuse to disclose who your fellow workers are. Really, all I'm trying to do in making that point is I want to stay exactly as I can on the First Amendment.
Are there any more questions, Mr. Davis? Thank you very much for your excellent testimony. Mr. Chalmers, are you from Salem or elsewhere?
Eugene.
You're next. Will you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, sir. My name is Don Chalmers. I'm a University of Oregon Law School student. And some of my testimony may be duplicitous in light of Mr. Davis' testimony. However, my conclusion will be somewhat different than his, and so I hope that I can go through my whole presentation and you'll be able to get the gist of the whole thing. Before I go into my written testimony, I would like to respond to Mr. Davis' point from the Michigan Law Review. I believe that you could read the Michigan Law Review article point in a different way. For instance, on page 270 of that Law Review, the author indicates that he's asked the respondents, in the last 18 months, has your coverage of any story been adversely affected by the possibility that you might be subpoenaed? And the response was, of 887 randomly selected newsmen, 8% said yes, and 81% said no. So at least the Law Review seems to indicate that there is no real drying up of sources as a result of Caldwell or the other decisions that have happened for the last 18 months. I'd like to make that one point clear. I think, however, those few doubt contributions of a free press to the state of our democratic society. For this and other reasons, the jailing of reporters who refuse to disclose their sources has caused much concern amongst those of us who see incarceration as being a restraint on the operation of that free press. Many of us had hoped that the restraint would be found to be unconstitutional in light of the First Amendment, as Mr. Davis indicated, only to be disappointed by the Supreme Court in Brandsburg versus Hayes. In that case, the Supreme Court decided there was no inherent right against disclosure to be found in the First Amendment. But a careful reading of the majority decision makes it clear that individual states, as well as the federal government, have the right and the capacity to establish a statutory privilege. For that matter, the court in that decision pointed to 13 states that at that time had already established such a privilege. It is indeed time that Oregon hold true to its progressive image and its progressive tradition in highways, education, and other areas, and become the 19th state to enact protection for journalists. Empirically, the need can be shown conclusively. In a study done in the Michigan Law Review, Professor Blassus of the Law Review faculty demonstrated that approximately 22% of all reporters, 22% of reporters, I'll try that one more time. All reporters depend on 22% of their stories from confidential reporters, confidential sources, and that reporters count on about 12% first-time confidential sources for their stories. So you can see that about one-fifth to one-third of the stories we read in today's newspaper may come from confidential sources. You might see this Michigan Law Review for a very excellently done empirical study. Surely Oregon cannot afford to allow its quantity of information to be stifled, and at the same time hope to keep the public as well informed as it might be. So assuming that a need for a shield law has been shown, there remain several policy questions that face this committee. At this time, there are three possible choices. First is the approach taken by the sponsors of the Senate Bill 206, often termed the Governor's Bill. The second possibility is incorporated in Senate Bill 32, establishing immunity for newsmen subject to the same kinds of constraints that are established for doctors and clients and attorneys and clients and others. Finally, there's a third possibility, providing for complete protection for newsmen subject to divestment under special ad hoc circumstances. This protection is found in House Bill 2104 and Senate Bill 97. A central question that surrounds this policy discussion is establishing a proper balance between the public's right to know and the right of citizens to be protected from harm and to be allowed full protection of due process. The policy incorporated in Senate Bill 206 seems to swing in favor of the public's right to know, extending due process protections only in the case of civil defamation and civil defamation action defenses. On the other hand, House Bill 2104 allows for the same civil protections as well as sets up stringent burdens of proof in the event that the right to know should be sublimated by the protection of human life or a compelling and overriding state interest. I term the test stringent because the requirements of a clear and convincing evidence test are between those of a preponderance of an evidence and those set up for a beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a test for criminal convictions. Because House Bill 2104 provides for an ad hoc divestment procedure under only the most compelling situations, I feel it adequately protects both the press and the public. Attached to this presentation are a list of 14 of the 18 states that have enacted shield laws. It's particularly handy because it gives you the year enacted, whether or not it's an absolute protection, who's covered, the language it's used by who's covered, the media included, any qualifications, where it can be asserted. I'll include that with my testimony and possibly you can run copies off for your quick reference. I'm sure Mr. Davis's 18 statutes will be helpful to you in detailed analysis. Included in this is a summary of each major position of the statutes that I've mentioned. You will note that of the 14 that are listed, 12 have absolute protections of some sort. But I hope you also take note of the New York Law Revision Commission report when they stated in 1949 that after weighing the conflicting interests involved, the commission unanimously concluded that 1, an unconditional privilege should not, in the public interest, be granted to newsmen to refuse to divulge the sources of information on which the news stories are based, and that 2, a privilege with safeguards essential to the protection of the public interest may be safely granted. In summary, I'd like to urge you to consider as an alternative to the governor's bill, House Bill 2104, which provides for divestment of the protection in the instance of a clear and convincing evidence of a threat to human life and in the instance of a compelling and overriding state interest. The final point I think I can make is this, that those tests are so harsh and so complete that only in the instance where the court would make an ad hoc decision would the pressman's protection ever be divested. That in setting up a divestment proceeding, you're really providing that each time someone wants that information, each time someone wants that source, they're going to be forced to go to the circuit court, or if you prefer, the Court of Appeals, and request that particular information, that particular source be divested or be offered because there's a threat to human life. We're trying to do the balancing act, trying to balance between the right to know and the right to be protected. It seems to me that an individual's life may be worth the divestment of that privilege in one particular instance. I would agree with the governor that in the area where divestment comes easily and comes in a rather superficial test found in many of the state bills, that kind of protection really doesn't give adequate press protection. But I think that in this instance, we're talking about particular and special and highly sophisticated divestment proceedings. You're really going to protect both the right to know as well as the right to be protected by government. I made some notes. I have fortunate enough to take legislation from a professor at the University of Oregon Law School. And one of the first things he said to me was, never use definitions unless you absolutely have to, because they get you in trouble. And I think that the governor's bill provides you with an excellent example of that. I don't care to take more of your time to knock the governor's bill, but I would urge you to at least take out the not limited to language, which was a second taboo that Professor Brody raised, and that you try to find some way to incorporate the definition of newsman, possibly in the manner that I have in House Bill 2104 or in any of the other bills that are before you, simply because I think that, as Senator Fahey has indicated, the problem can be that grand juries and committees like this, well, judges should have the opportunity to act individual citizens, not specifically protected by privileges, to render information. You should have the opportunity to ask the PUC why they're doing what they're doing. And I think that, again, we're facing an issue of balancing the interest of the right to know and the right of citizens to be protected. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond to them.
Ms.
Paul?
Yeah, that's 70 Michigan Law Review 307. That's December 71. There's also, if you're interested, I can also give you about three other sources. They're really excellent.
Why don't you write them on your notes, because we'll make a copy of those and pass them out to the committee.
Yeah, I think you'll find that there are probably two anthologies of the legal aspects of this issue that might be valuable to you. You don't have
attorney already. I have one question. Anybody else? The original 2104 has the divested under the circuit court. Would you prefer that be the appellate court?
I think that in light of the provisions for appeal, it may not make too much difference, except for convenience to the reporter. If you provide for divestment, you want to have some kind of decision on the part of the court that can be somewhat final, so that once the court says no divestment, the reporter can go on his merry way. 2104, as it now stands, provides for stays, so you could stay the divestment proceeding pending appeal. But balancing that with reporter's convenience, I would say that the Court of Appeals would probably be the more appropriate body to hear those kind of divestment proceedings. It may cause a problem for some of those judges to hear this kind of thing. I might add, now as you mentioned it, that the experience that Louisiana has had with a divestment proceeding is that because the test is so demanding, very few people will try to move ahead and ask for divestment. And then there's two constraints. One, it's simply not popular to try to pin a reporter down who's done a good job of exposing corruption, crime, whatever. And the second thing is that the test, clear and convincing evidence, as well as compelling and overriding, that combined together makes it a rough test that people aren't willing to hassle it. You're talking about the possibility of the prosecutor sending out informants to get the same information. A prosecutor is not going to hassle clear and convincing evidence and compelling and overriding state interest when he can hire some guy to go out and spy on the same people and find out the information he wants to find out. It's not. I don't think that the investment proceeding that I'm talking about is going to inhibit the ability of the press to go out and get the information the public has the right to know. What I'm trying to say is, and I could have probably said this in one sentence, is that I see 2104 to be the best possible bill for the interest of both the society and the reporters, and I find that the governor's bill represents the best interest of the reporters. And if you're willing to do the balancing, you're willing to accept the balance of society's rights as well as the press rights, you'll go to 2104 over the governor's bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next witness is Lloyd Passman.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lloyd Passman. I'm what is referred to, I hope, as a working newsman, and that is a reporter for the Daily Oregon newspaper. And I'd also like to note that I'm the first one to appear here tonight who stands to end up behind bars if we don't get some kind of law like this passed. I would wholeheartedly concur in the comments made by Senator Bow, Mr. Davis, and others who have or will testify urging passage of Senate Bill 206. You have my written statement, and I won't take your time with it tonight except to make two points. I'm a member of the Eugene Newspaper Guild, which is affiliated with the International Newspaper Guild, which represents more than 33,000 newspaper employees in the United States and Canada. This committee has organized itself and taken up this shield law so rapidly that our local union really hasn't had time to develop a formal position statement on it. But I'm confident that the majority of our members would concur in the position of our international organization. That is, strong support for an unqualified legal protection of what we regard as our constitutional right to do our job. Indeed, our local took this position when this issue was before the 1971 state legislature. Secondly, I would simply like to say that I regard the term privilege as used in this sense as something of a misnomer. As Mr. Davis correctly points out, protection of the reporter is not the issue here. If a shield law is a privilege, it is only in the negative sense that a newsman will be privileged to not go to jail in order to preserve his effectiveness as a reporter. I see no benefit other than that to him as an individual. I appreciate your time here this evening, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
I think you're the first working press who has complimented the legislature on its feet. I appreciate that.
I didn't hear that.
Are there any questions, Mr. Passman? Has the guild ever changed from a qualified to an unqualified shield law?
To my knowledge, the guild has always supported an unqualified law. Our position in 1971 at the local level was that no law should be passed. And the reason for that was we thought that we had adequate protection under the Constitution. Unfortunately, recent events, as I say in my statement, have indicated that we were wrong. And it is very reluctantly, I should say, that persons in my position have come to the position of having to support passage of a shield law.
Mr. Carson.
Lloyd, without asking you to divulge particular, is the concern you registered when you sat down imminent? In other words, do you personally feel a threat in Oregon in this regard, or do you see just flashes on the horizon?
I've made a very unscientific survey among my colleagues around the state, and to my knowledge, there is no pending situation where an Oregon reporter, a legitimate newsman or illegitimate newsman, is in danger of going to jail. However, as I believe Mr. Davis pointed out, the danger is that the mere threat of that happening is enough to begin to dry up the sources, the Michigan Law Review notwithstanding. I think I would have to say that if one source is dried up because of court decisions in this area, that is a disservice to the public.
Any further questions, Mr. Johnson? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Bill Wassman?
Bob, I promise you I was going to just say I agree with the governor's bill and go home in the interest of mercy. But first of all, I'll tell you that I'm Bill Wassman. I'm the managing editor of the Register Guard at Eugene. And I sincerely came here with every intention of seconding Mr. Davis's remarks. And I still do that. I'm quite sure that you can iron out the definitions to somebody's satisfaction, Senator Staley or whoever. I don't think it's a very important point. I don't feel it's a very important point because I would, I'm not being facetious now, but I sincerely say that I would trust Senator Fader to put out his newsletter. I don't feel threatened by it at all. In the case of government and the legislature, I think they're in quite a different position from the working press, if you will. They must stand the heat of public opinion after we get done with it. So I do not feel that this is a tremendous problem. I don't think that it should be too difficult to overcome. I would sincerely hope that it would not mean the end of this bill, the governor's bill, I mean. As for studies, Michigan Law Review, I have not read the article. I gather that the gist of part of it, at least, is that we have facts and figures offered, correct me if I am incorrect, as to how much drying up of sources there has been. And I would ask you that when a source is dried up, how do you keep count? If it dries up, it isn't there. So how do you count nothing? How do you know? Then, finally, I would make one last plea, coming from a citizen of Oregon, the city of Eugene, the intellectual home of Annette Buchanan. that you pass this governor's bill with the thought in mind that you are bringing back to Oregon many places that I really don't want to defend this statement or give you a fact. I do not really have a fact. It is just a sort of a gut reaction that with the Peter Bridge case in New Jersey and the Caldwell case and Annette Buchanan, we have in Oregon, I would very much fear a drying up of sources already. But I can't count them. And you can't count them. And she can't count them any more than Michigan law reviews can count them. I don't know. I'm really not trying to downgrade this thing. I would just be hope that you gentlemen and ladies would put your attention on a definition which you can live with and that you give us a bill such as 206, an unqualified privilege bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. And
since I raised some of the questions initially, although there were others who also came in on it, certainly it is a very serious matter. It involves the First Amendment and also involves the public rights known in complete sense. What's actually being suggested is that the public not know everything, not know the source of the news and information, because they will know a greater amount if he may publish without disclosing that information, without the threat of disclosing that information. Now, I think there's nothing more serious. On the other hand, if we had everybody included within the definition of newsmen, the law would soon not work at all. People would write it out of town on the rail. But probably the definition of newsman or one who works is the most important portion of this. It is a protection of a special interest, a special profession that provides the public information. And the only way that the public can get complete information is through some sort of protection of those members of that profession. Likewise, it seems to me we have to limit the protection to those who are engaged in that relationship, namely supplying information to the public on a professional basis. And how much hair the guy's got hasn't got anything to do with whether he's professional or not.
I hope not.
So what I'm saying is I think the definition is a very important part of this, and I wouldn't have and don't raise it as a matter of nitpicking. We need to have it right.
No, Ed, I'm not saying that you're raising it as a matter of nitpicking at all. And as I said before, I sincerely hope that you can solve this problem, and I'm quite sure that you can. To me, it is not the most important thing at all, though. And
right on.
I've been in this or some other room like it. If you could show me where the restroom is, I could tell you whether it was this room or not.
We remodeled, Bill. We remodeled.
We moved
it.
The important thing is that I think that as of this time, for reasons outside the state and a reason inside the state, that it is my gut reaction that Oregon has now a climate in which an informant of anything really touchy and important might be hesitant to go to this woman or to his radio station or to my newspaper. Because I know very well, and he knows very well, what kind of treatment I'm going to get in a Lane County Circuit Court. Doesn't mean anything against the Lane County Circuit Court at all. It just simply means the judge is standing there with his hands tied. All he can do, once the district attorney has hailed me in there, is say, you answer the question. Coming from Lane County, I think you know this, and being skilled in the law, you know this better than I know it. Thank you very much.
I have a question. Do any of the rest of you have a question? Mrs. Paulus raised a point. What about government press officials? Do they have the same right of immunity and steel?
Bob, I wish that I could answer the question. I think that you aimed that question or a cousin of that question at a previous witness. Is that correct?
My question was,
It was in response to Ed having raised a question.
The way the bill is presently drafted, it seems to me that a state agency, a person charged in the state agency with preparing an informational pamphlet for the public, could not be detail before a legislative committee to find out the basis for the information.
It's quite possible. It's quite possible. I understand you're a lawyer.
Yes.
This is not my league. It really isn't. It's not my league. I am particularly interested in another section of this bill, namely that part having to do with the privilege. There is a variety in 18 bills now enacted in the United States, a variety of definitions. The New York bill, I believe, is an unlimited bill. It takes very few lines, maybe 10 lines. The bill goes 300 pages. All the rest is definition, contrary to the advice you get at the University of Oregon Law School about definition. I don't know how else you can go about it. You people, if you are going to stay away from definition, and if you're going to cover news people and people who put out pamphlets in general terms, you're going to be in deep trouble. So, as I am just simply pleading for an unlimited privilege. The definition part, I don't worry about. I have a tendency to feel that a bill which would say, for example, have some exclusions in them. Some of these 18 bills do have exclusions in them. How important is this information, for example? One of the typical exclusions. Another one is the source of this information, is this information available at another place other than the newspaper man? Which is another typical exclusion. I don't think these are really necessary, because I feel, and maybe this is precedent too, the reason I feel this way, that if any reporter that I know of or have ever met in my life, no matter how responsible or how irresponsible he was, and I've known both kinds, on this coast and on the east coast, I still feel, no matter how irresponsible and how airtight his shield, that if it came down to testifying to save your life, he would do it.
Any more questions of Mr. Watson? Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
J. Richard Joslin, is it?
No.
J. Richard Noakes, managing editor of the Oregonian. Well, I too would like to endorse what Senator Bull and Mr. Davis have said before me, and Bill Wassman too. Someone has said, and I think wisely so, that a newspaper is as good as its sources. And I think that's pretty much what we're talking about here tonight. I think quite sincerely, newspaper people who are concerned about this matter today are not concerned alone for themselves and their own welfare and well-being and the possibility of keeping out of jail. But I think they are really concerned that if what is happening in America today is allowed to continue, that it will redound against the best interests of the readers of the newspapers and the listeners to the broadcasters, that the public really will not be as well informed because of the drying up of potential sources. Yours is not the only body which is considering legislation such as this. The federal Congress has some 25 bills before it on the subject today, including one which was written by Senator Mark Hatfield. We've had discussions from previous witnesses that Justice Douglas and Governor Reagan of California have, at the opposite points of the poll, opposite polls, have endorsed some kind of shield legislation, absolute in both cases, I believe. Senator Hatfield, who also is somewhere in the middle, possibly between these two other gentlemen, and who also is, on occasion, has had some problems with the press and coverage, also endorses an absolute privilege for the press. I think he spoke quite eloquently the other day when he was on the floor introducing his measure. Let me just quote briefly from some of the remarks that the senator said. Free from interference, the press is able to provide us with information on what is happening in all levels of government, from the White House to the county courthouse. It is important to remember that what is at stake here is not just the rights of a few large newspapers or wire services, but also of the small dailies and weeklies throughout the country. We are not only talking about the rights of the Nicholas von Hoffman and the James J. Kilpatricks of journalism, but also about the rights of the City Hall reporter providing us with information about the conduct of our local government. Indeed, the protection of these rights may be more important to small newspapers and local broadcast stations, since they lack the legal and financial resources to combat a flurry of subpoenas. If they are forced out of business because of high court costs, our supply of information will be limited further. Without the information uncovered by diligent reporters or supplied them by confidential sources, we would only have the unchallenged assertions of public officials themselves, making it virtually impossible for us to make informed judgments, placing blame where it belongs, giving credit where it is due. I would like to underline that concerning small publications and small radio stations and television stations. The major press, about which we all think when we're talking about some kind of a freedom of information measure, the New York Times or one of the leading magazines such as Newsweek or Time, or NBC or ABC, or the Oregonian or the Register Guard, we think, well, these big concerns like this should be able to take care of themselves, and quite probably they can in most cases. But let's talk about the Tigard or Beaverton Times, or the Cell Would Be, or the radio station you mentioned of limited listenership in a more remote part of the state. Let's talk about those for just a moment. How well are they protected? We think all the press needs this, and I realize, Senator Fadley, the difficulty of writing a definition. This concerns the press. It has concerned it. And granted, we can grant such protection for the New York Times, clearly, and for Time Magazine, clearly, and the Oregonian, clearly, and the Register Guard, and the Salem Statesman, and so on. But let's get down. Let's get down to Common Cause, which might want to issue a publication of certain general circulation. Let's get down to the ACLU, which might want to issue a publication of general circulation. Let's get down to the Cell Would Be. I don't think that we would be really good newspapermen, really good journalists, if we considered only those members of the major commercial press when we're talking about this bill. Now, I realize that your committee and the legislature have to have some kind of a definition in the bill. You're probably going to have to labor mightily over it. But I would encourage you to consider the broadest possible application of this protection.
Thank you, Dick. Are there questions that have been up? I'd like to ask you one, Dick. Have you changed your mind at any time relative to a qualified and unqualified skill?
That's an embarrassing question, Bob.
Well, I just thought I'd ask.
Well, I think until the Supreme Court decision of nearly 2 years ago, which was articulated by Justice White, until that came along, we had thought we did have a degree of protection under the First Amendment. And that possibly in an enlightened state as Oregon is, where we've had at that time only, I think, one major problem for most of a century, we did not feel the urgency that we feel today for having some kind of a shield law. But I think I can agree with Mr. Passman today that the working press is wholeheartedly behind a shield law such as you're considering tonight.
Thank you. It's nothing. I beg your pardon, Bob. Jim Sullivan signed up for you.
I think you're not going to go first.
All right.
That's my block.
I know.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert C. Knotson, and I'm publisher of the Oregonian. I would like to enlarge just a little in my testimony on something that Mr. Noakes has just said, and that is the importance of extending any privilege under this law rather widely. Our American democratic system was generated and encouraged substantially by the courageous pamphleteers in the pre-revolutionary period. They were not professional newspapermen as we know it. They were not recognized as such, but they expressed ideas that fired the spark of liberty and unified the American people against what they believe to be an unjust system of taxation and suppression. They used essays of men like John Adams, Samuel Adams, and John Otis, the fiery speeches of Patrick Henry and all, to bring a unity to our people. Now, our society has become more complex, our government more pervasive, and newspapers have filled a larger and larger function in informing the public in reference to the conduct of government, constructive and occasionally destructive. When I speak of the press, of course, I include the broadcast media, which have added a new dimension to our informational picture. And all of these daily disseminate the information by which a citizen may know and exercise some influence on the course of the event. And without that flow of information, the right of the citizen and his influence is restricted. Now, the press stands as a watchdog over government, analyzing its performance and pointing out its weaknesses. Improprieties and wrongdoing are exposed. Well, this is, in my opinion, an outstanding public benefit. And without that kind of a watchdog to supervise the course of government, democracy as we know it might not function very long. The Virginia Bill of Rights said it well in 1776, and it remains emphatically true today. The freedom of the press is one of the greatest bulwarks of liberty and can never be restrained but by despotic government. For many years, as has been emphasized here by Bill Wasserman and other witnesses, it was axiomatic that the First Amendment, so-called freedom of press doctrine, extended a certain umbrella over the activity of newspaper men, not only in the publication of in-depth reporting, but also in the gathering of that information. And judges, district attorneys, seem to agree that this is the case. So that in Oregon, we did not have a cause célèbre for some 100 years until the Buchanan case. And during this time, I think most of us preferred that we should not have what other states had adopted, which we tended to regard as class legislation. We wanted no legislative privilege as such. Well, the Buchanan case has been widely heralded. It caused hang-ups for people in all kinds of ways. Certainly, it demonstrated there was a problem there, but the solution to that problem brought all kinds of differences, not only among legislators, but among newspaper people themselves. More recently, the Caldwell case, the New York Times reporter in San Francisco, this case, both in the district court and the circuit court, was held that a reporter should not be compelled to reveal information from confidential sources unless he was the only source for the information and there was a compelling public need. As you know, and as has been observed here, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, overturned this decision. And Justice White, in writing the opinion, found there was no constitutional privilege that adhered to a newspaper man more than to any other citizen in these regards. Now, there were dissents, and I'll not go into detail on those except to say that Justice William O. Douglas contended that the First Amendment provided absolute privilege to newspaper men, and that in the only case he could think of that it did not was the case where if the newspaper man himself were involved in a crime, and he said in that case, of course, the Fifth Amendment stood as a barrier sufficient to protect the man from having to testify. The decision of Justice Potter Stewart, however, was almost classic from a newspaper standpoint. The court in these cases holds that a newspaper man has no First Amendment right to protect his sources when called before a grand jury. The court thus invites state and federal authorities to undermine the historic independence of the press by attempting to annex the journalistic profession as an investigative arm of government. Not only will this decision impair performance of the press constitutionally in its protected function, but it will, I am convinced, in the long run, harm rather than help administrative justice, and I respectfully dissent. He went on to say that a corollary of the right to publish must be the right to gather news, and that it implies in turn a right of a confidential relationship between the reporter and his source. We have had in rapid succession the Bridge case, the Parr case, the Lawrence case. We've had a series of federal subpoenas, some of which were quashed. There are more than a dozen cases, I understand, pending around the country now, cases of contempt owing to refusal of newspapermen to divulge sources or information. The threat to newsmen then has become a matter of public national concern. I would stress, as Mr. King did, however, that this is not a newsman's privilege, in fact, because it is a protection of the public's right to know. Actually, newspaper men could be very content and take it very easy, simply sitting back and publishing handouts, material that was given to them, and where they did no digging, no in-depth effort, no effort to find out what was behind the story and whether there was wrongdoing or impropriety. Well, it ought to be apparent that a person who is in a vulnerable spot is not going to assume the high risk of being identified, the risk of his position, his person, or to his livelihood. And so, the corollary of the right to publish must be the right to gather the news, and this, as I've indicated, was the emphasis of Justice Potter Stewart. And so there's been a wave of support for so-called shield laws. If you were to ask me what kind of a bill I would like to see, I'd like to see a bill that would make a firm statement of public policy not to require a reporter to divulge confidential information or sources of such information. Two, that this would not be available as a defense in a libel action, so that a person who wanted to could confront his accuser. Three, that it would not be available when a reporter has original knowledge of a crime himself. Four, that the privilege would continue even if a man changed jobs. We had a situation in California where the judge held that the privilege under the California law was divested owing to the fact that the man no longer worked for the paper for whom he wrote the original story. In New Jersey, we had a somewhat different interpretation where it was held that if the reporter published a portion of the information he obtained from the source, he thereby waived his immunity. And so I think the law should protect the reporter in both of those regards. Now, there are, in my opinion, substantial arguments for absolute privilege, and you've heard some of them here tonight. And many newsmen and lawmakers fear that there could be abuse under an absolute privilege law. I can see there is considerable difficulty in defining a bona fide newspaper man. There also would be the danger that you could be putting outside the law a pamphleteer who might be contributing to our national future as the pamphleteers did in years past. Well, I would not oppose absolute privilege, although I recognize that this matter of definition is a very real one, and I have wrestled with it, and I have not been able to find an entirely satisfactory answer. I would say this, however, that there are very few rights and privileges in life that are absolute. I would think that if a reporter had the knowledge of a crime, and if the information was not otherwise available, and there were a danger that the ends of justice would be defeated if there were an overriding public need that he might have reason and his source might have reason to reconsider for the idea that the information under the pressure of the court might be made available. I think you would see that under a qualified privilege that there would be no need to define a newsman precisely, because if his testimony was required, whether he be a pamphleteer or a professional newspaper man working for a small or big newspaper would make no difference. The court would require it. It would be up to him then to answer the court in the matter. I think I would be willing to try, as Senator President, as the Senate President Bowe has indicated he would, a qualified privilege. And I would put my faith in the Oregon courts to administer it equitably. If it didn't work, I would go on to unqualified privilege. Now, that would be my personal preference. However, opinion nationally and locally has been solidifying behind unqualified or absolute privilege. Senator Cranston's bill at the national level and Governor McCall's bill at the state level are patterned after the model law of the Newspaper Publishers Association. Senator Hatfield, who has been joined by Senate Minority Leader Mansfield, has proposed a bill which is very similar to the ONPA bill which you have before you, and I can't identify its number for you. I don't have the published bill.
2104, I believe, Bob.
97. The Hatfield-Mansfield bill is roughly the ONPA, first half of the ONPA bill without the divestiture feature. So it is unqualified privilege. Senator Hatfield told me that he felt that there was some doubt, as you have been told here tonight, that a qualified privilege would be equitably administered, and that it could still serve to restrain freedom of the press. Well, even lawyer groups who have been opposing any kind of privilege in the past are coming around on this, and I say from Mr. Sterling's paper, UPI Dispatch tonight, a lawyer group in a lawyer group in New York, the Association of the Bar of the City of New York, has gone on record in favor of a protection of reporters from forced disclosure of sources of unpublished information received in confidence, and asked that Congress adopt appropriate legislation. It is, however, a qualified privilege. 20th Century Fund organized a committee consisting of attorneys, newsmen, judges, legislators. They came up with a similar finding. I think that probably, however, most newspaper men and broadcasters at this point would favor the unqualified privilege. If the committee can arrive at a definition that suits them and language of the law, I would accept that. I would not oppose it. I would accept it in the interest of unity, and with the idea, as Mr. King has said, that if the law did not work according to its specifications, that it could and would be changed. And I would certainly favor a change if it did not. Now, I want to add one further thing. I regret the confrontation that has grown up here. Historically, and throughout my career, certainly, reporters, editors have cooperated with district attorneys and sheriffs in passing along to them information which might be of help to them in making a proper investigation, using the tools which they have and which newspaper men do not always have, the tools of subpoena and so on, to ascertain an investigation to arrive at certain facts and cases where matters did not look exactly right. In turn, district attorneys have generally been cooperative with newspaper men in accepting from them this information, but at the same time not hitting them over the head or their informants over the head in such a way as to shut off and close off these legitimate sources of information and sources which they need to carry on their work. And I have felt that in the long run this was to the public interest. Therefore, when we get into this area of confrontation where the district attorney and the courts no longer cooperate with the press, no longer cooperates with them, I think it is contrary to the public interest. And I hope that very soon this confrontation may be alleviated by some kind of a statute here which will get us all on the same wavelength again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. We appreciate it. Are there questions for Mr. Nelson?
I have one.
Okay.
The ANPA appears to have changed its, the American Newspaper Publishers Association appears to have changed its attitude on a qualified or an unqualified shield law within the last 6 months. Are you familiar with that or why?
Yes, I am. The Federal Laws Committee of the ANPA, of which I am a member, along with the representatives of five other news organizations, met in Washington, I think it was last July, and went on record favoring qualified privilege. The at that time, it appeared that the entire industry probably would be unified behind this type of legislation. And later on, one other organization, I think in September, also joined that group. About that time, however, there were some things happened that tended to stiffen the situation a little and on the national scene, and Senator Vance Hartke made a talk to the board of the ANPA in which he asked them and advised them to stiffen their attitude, whereupon the board, general board, went on record then in favor of absolute privilege and asked their counsel to prepare the statute from which the governor's bill is drawn. The ASNE board, very shortly thereafter, meeting in October, also reversed its committee and adopted the same attitude. I think that this is a trend so far as the other news gathering organizations are concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. No more questions.
Ms. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we could get a copy of the model law just referred to by Mr. Knudsen. The governor has indicated that this bill, the governor's bill, 207, is based substantially on the model law proposed by the American Newspaper Publishers Association. I would like to see what the differences are.
Do you have it, or do you have it?
I'm one of the working newspaper persons at the Oregonian, and it's a good thing to follow my bosses, so I can say I echo and agree with the principles of most of the previous speakers. I thought maybe I might like to sketch for you a few practical examples of some of the people we might like to keep talking to us. Not all of these are my stories, but they're among my experiences on the Oregonian, and maybe this will give a little practical insight into it. I have some misgivings about definition of newsmen. I, at one time, probably would not have protected Annette Buchanan. I did not feel the girl did a very good story or a balanced story, and she gave me a bad time when I was down there, and not the Register guys. We were trying to tell her story.
There's a member of the audience who will agree with you, and he's going to testify in a few minutes.
All right. I want to give just a few quick little examples. We once had a district attorney in Multnomah County who didn't prosecute gambling. As a matter of fact, he traded little money with some people who were doing some gambling. We had a couple of reporters who won a Pulitzer Prize. They could not have gotten their information if they hadn't been able to talk to a great many people. The same district attorney, in his effort to keep things rather quiet, went before a judge and lied to get a subpoena. Here you see it's a little meaner for a district attorney to lie before a judge than it is the ordinary citizen. He said he wanted some tapes, and he said they were naughty tapes. They must have had very bad, evil things, you know, like we're having in theaters on them. He wanted to seize these tapes. So the interesting thing about these tapes were they were recordings of conversations in which the district attorney was getting some money from some Chinese gambling. Well, we had informants in police, we had informants in the district attorney's office, some of his employees. This same district attorney subpoenaed a great many people into court. I am sure that he would have been happy to fire and shut up some of these if he knew who they were. One of the most interesting sources to us was the man who happened to be in the office the night he was trying to find out what was on all these tapes. they spilled one, and they had 500 yards of tape all over the office and took them 7 hours to rewind it off. That was a bit of information we used. I have had many people call me. I hope they continue to call me because I'm accurate and honest with what I say. And I hope they continue to call me because they know I would protect them if they got into trouble. From a practical standpoint, a newspaper man over there knows that most of the news we gather is available to us from many sources. I can go down and write about a coach that gets drunk on the highway, and it all happens in court, including the bells which pealed in the top of the tower as we came down the steps. And then one of my editors cut out that beautiful line. All right? As you know, we have a new city government in Portland. There's all sorts of strange and interesting things going on in our city hall. There are a lot of people fighting with each other. There are people being fired, people being transferred, commissioners losing jobs. We like to keep a lot of people talking to us. It's particularly important now for our voters in Portland to know what city government is doing. I have had some city employees call me at night to say they were transferred and want to talk about it, and we haven't used this bit of information yet, but it may come up sometime. I want them to keep telling me about it. A long time ago, there was a county detective in Multnomah County. I used to cover a lot of murder trials and a lot of police investigations. He worked for the district attorney on quite a lot of murder investigations. He wanted to tell me about some witnesses in a murder case that hadn't been called. The district attorney in this case felt strongly that these witnesses would not help the case. They were not important to the case. He didn't believe them. However, eventually a judge, and it was in Marion County, eventually a judge decided these witnesses were important to the case. When I first heard about the witnesses, I found them so interesting that I think this time the editors were right. They put it on the front page. And it really created quite a fuss for a while, and a great many people remembered that about this case. Unfortunately, this man that was being tried wasn't a very good citizen, but then we want to keep all information about all citizens before people. I've been called before grand juries, and I've been called as a witness in cases. I'm not going to ever protect a murderer or someone's life, but I think I would try to protect someone who might lose a job, and people are mean sometimes if they know who has talked. I've had judges give me information, attorneys give me information, policemen give me information, ordinary citizens. In the Oregon prison riot in 1968, which some of you legislators are familiar about, I've forgotten what the millions of dollars it was it finally cost, I had a great many people talking to me before this, telling me about a great deal of unrest in the prison. Two nights before the prison riot, I was down in Salem sitting in a home of some of the prison guards till about 3 a.m. in the morning because they wanted to tell me about unrest in the prison. Well, they were beefing about many of the usual things that employees beef everywhere: more money, better working conditions, and so forth. But they also were telling me of some internal troubles with the then warden, who was very, very sick. We didn't know that. We didn't know that the legislators who had kept this warden on, Dooley was about 72, had lung cancer, had a heart attack and pneumonia, and was still trying to run the prison from his home. We wish we dug that out sooner. Well, I was called before the grand jury in Multnomah County to testify about that, what information I had of that riot. I had a story in the Oregonian the morning of the riot saying there was great unrest in the prison and great unrest among guards. We just knew something was going to blow, and it did. Your district attorney called me before the grand jury here in Marion County, and I think I testified for several hours. Now, he never asked me the names of any of those guards. I would protect those guards because some of them are still working there, and at that time they still had a boss that they might have been afraid of. I had some information from a variety of convicts about trouble coming on. Gortmager did not ask me their names or ask me to divulge that. He had his own good ways of knowing what was going on there, and he pursued them, and he did it right. But he was interested in principles and things. I didn't agree with what the grand jury finally found, but from a practical standpoint, this district attorney and I were getting along fine. I have always had good relations with district attorneys and policemen. I hope they will trust me. I like to keep people talking. I have an example tonight now of one that I think could be a field question. A young reporter of ours is going to go up to Vancouver, British Columbia tomorrow. We're interested in what happens to the AWOL and the DAF Dodgers up there now that the war is over. We're interested in their philosophies, in their feeling, what they think now. We feel, the Oregonian feels, that all of this together will be of a great deal of interest to people here. Now, I know our reporter didn't have a very good in on who to find up there. He had heard of one or two kids, and he was just going to go up there and see if he could hunt them up at maybe some of the coffee houses. But I know the name of one boy who is AWOL from the Army. His mother is a good friend of mine. It's a very grievous thing in this family. This boy served 3.5 years in Germany. Then the Army wanted to send him to Vietnam, and he decided he didn't want to go to Vietnam. He went to Canada instead. He will or is under indictment. I could conceivably think of the FBI or whoever asking me, what did this boy say to me, or ask this other reporter, what did this boy say to you? They do have their own ways of getting him and bringing him back. But in this case, I talked to this reporter and made sure that he understood that we would protect this boy. We would protect the boy in not divulging where he was or what he'd said to us, other than what we've used in the paper. I don't know what's going to come of it. He may not even talk to us. But in this case, we want to know what all of them feel. We would like to tell the people in Oregon what all of these people feel, and we feel it's in the public interest to find them. I feel that employees are the ones that talk to us often. And most of what we talked about here tonight is investigatory type of reporting. But I would like to keep the climate right. I'd like to keep the climate good so that all peoples will talk to us. Not because they have something underhanded in someone else, but because they can tell us something that will add to our knowledge, and so they can continue to talk to us. I don't want people to be afraid of us. I'll answer any questions.
And I appreciate all your remarks, except the inaccurate ones about editors. Are there any questions, Ms. Sullivan? Thank you very much. Our next witness is the first one from the electronic media, John Salisbury.
Thank you. I'm John Salisbury, news director for KXL Radio, and I got a call late this afternoon from Dick Ross, who was supposed to be here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Dick had to do his 11 o'clock news tonight. I guess somebody was sick. So I'm here, and I'm wearing two hats, actually. One is to make a brief statement on the position of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters with regard to an unqualified shield law, and the other is to make a statement on the position of the Radio Television News Directors Association on the unqualified shield law. It is known in our parlance as the RTNDA, and it is one of the five that Bob Knotson spoke of when he mentioned five organizations, press organizations representing all media on the Joint Media Committee concerned with it. I am the Western Regional Director for the RTNDA, and my territory covers 13 Western states. I am one of two such directors. So in speaking of RTNDA activities, I am representing them as a national organization, as a Western Regional organization, and also we have several members here in Oregon in the electronic media of RTNDA. The Oregon Association of Broadcasters, because of the fact that I got a call this afternoon from John Firm, who is president of the organization, he merely filled me in. I don't have any formal statement to give you a copy of. You probably don't really need one, because basically, the position of the OAB is to stand behind an unqualified shield law. They originally gave their endorsement to the Herd plan, and this was before 206, the governor's bill, came before the Senate, came into the Senate. At this point, The OAB takes this stand. They would like an unqualified law. They are standing behind the other news organizations, particularly the Radio Television News Directors Association. They appointed me to serve on their Blue Ribbon Committee of the OAB because of my membership on the board of directors of that organization. They will stand behind whatever unqualified shield law this committee brings forth on the floor of the Senate and the House. They will stand behind 206, which is where we in the broadcast field stand today. And I think I speak for my colleagues in radio and television throughout Oregon that basically we favor the governor's bill, as it's called. As far as the Radio Television News Directors Association is concerned, I have received just last Friday a letter from our president, Charles Harrison of WGN Radio and Television in Chicago, asking me to canvass 5 western states, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Hawaii, and California, as to whether or not any of the newsmen that I know there have been under any kind of pressure by the courts or by other law agencies in this regard, and also to find out what other states, these other states, are doing legislatively on shield laws. I sent out a letter today to as many as I could in the 5 states, and we'll be receiving their responses, hopefully. And I would offer to share those responses with this committee, if you so desire, when I get them, but I imagine it'll be a week or two before they're all in. One thing, of course, that the RTNDA is doing is going before the subcommittee hearings of both the House and Senate in Washington, D.C., and this is one of the reasons why they want this information, to help them in their case to get an unqualified shield law nationally. Just in brief conclusion, I would like to say that as far as the confidential source is concerned, the general public feeling is that a confidential source is somebody that's whispering in your ear, and he may be a nefarious character from the lower depths, but a confidential source is, it can be anybody. It seems to me that the public itself is the reporter's supplement, and many members of the public are in effect reporters when they talk to us, and when they say, please don't quote me. And that includes legislators. I have had legislators tell me things about what was going on in the legislature that they thought might be helpful to me, but would prefer not to be quoted for one reason or another. Also, a confidential source often, if you get it into a court of law, I would imagine, would be considered hearsay evidence unless the reporter was on hand at the time of the event that's been reported to him by a confidential source. As far as subpoenas are concerned, I've never been subpoenaed, but I have been threatened. And just recently, and by a very minor agency. And I think this is one of the things which concerns us deeply, is the growing feeling that the word subpoena is going to scare all of us into revealing our sources. This was an agency in Portland, who shall remain nameless for the moment, who called me to find out what we had done on KXL about the shooting of the lions at the Portland Zoo. Not about the case that, when they found the young man who allegedly did it, but what we did on the original story. And in asking me the question, this gentleman, who was very friendly and all, he wasn't obstructive or particularly, he wasn't nasty about it. He just said, we'd like to have the material that you used on the air at that time. And I said, well, I really don't have any material, any special material to give you. I said, we used the Associated Press wire stories at that time. And he said, well, of course, we could subpoena your material. And I was very frightened at that point, and I said, go ahead and subpoena, but why don't you call the Associated Press? They've got it all. And I said, subpoena them and have fun. And he said, oh, no, I don't want to, I'm not trying to threaten you. And I said, well, you just told me that you might, that you'd subpoena me if I didn't turn over my information to you. And he said, well, of course, we have the right to subpoena anything we want. And I said, of course you do. What information you want, however, and what you get may be two entirely different things. So what we came down to finally, just to wind it up, was that I was very happy to send over a statement as to the fact that we had used the Associated Press wire service and that the statute of limitations for holding such copy in our files had passed and that we didn't have it anymore. We did one or two other things, but I didn't tell him about them. And frankly, I don't suppose that if I went back into my files, I could find them, because I don't think they got on the air, which is what's meant by outtake. But the point that I make here is that when they start throwing the word subpoena around in order to scare you into divulging information which they're afraid you're not going to give them, then we certainly are going to get terribly worried about freedom of the press, even in Oregon. And so I would simply conclude by saying, as a member, as a person, as an individual newsman, news director of KXL, representing my management, we support an unqualified law. We support at this point the Bill 206, the governor's law. The Radio Television News Directors Association members in this area support it, and so does the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Are there questions of Ms. Salisbury? John, I appreciate two things. One, that you came down here at this time, and I know you have to get up about 4 or 4:30. And the other is that legislators are not necessarily nefarious characters. Thank you, John. We have five more witnesses who have signed up. Dave Bernstein.
Dan Bernstein. I gave it to the secretary over the phone, so probably why they mixed up.
All right. Whoever you are, we're not going to ask you.
I represent the Salem Newspaper Guild. It's a recently formed unit, formed last August. I'm a reporter on the Capital Journal, and the Salem unit encompasses the Oregon Statesman and the Capital Journal. And as we're kind of caught in a similar situation as Mr. Passman, we're in the midst of negotiating our first contract and have spent virtually no time at all discussing a shield law. And I just found out about this meeting this morning and have been trying to scrape together a committee. And we want to come to you with a position in about the next 10 days or mail it to you. We will have a statement for you, but you have nothing at this time. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, Dan, if you'll just send us, I think that'll be fine. If we may have another hearing if there's a public demand for it, but so far we're trying to take care of everyone who's asked us here. So we'll see if we have another public hearing.
Yes.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Representative Engels, I realize you didn't say anything, so it shouldn't be any questions. I just want to give a hypothetical case.
Nevertheless.
Yeah, I just want to give your committee a hypothetical case to work on, which may not be completely unbelievable here in this community, but then again, it may be. I'm concerned about the case where a newsman or a newsman's close associate is, say, running for office against, in this instance, the district attorney. And suppose that newsman prints a story that the district attorney actually set fire to the state fair building and was prosecuted for a crime that he had himself perpetrated or started. And then the district attorney called the newsman in to get his source. Now, maybe there's some protection in the libel law. If all you've said is that the district attorney is directly implicated in setting the fire himself, I'm not sure, since he's a district attorney and a public official, and you can say that you believe the source, and therefore you're not acting out of malice when you make it. As a matter of fact, if it was done 10 days before the election, it wouldn't be possible to retract it 2 days after the election. Avoid most of the problems that are there. What I'm really saying is there, in your committee, I would like for them to consider, is there any need or any problem created by the fact that it's possible to misuse any confidential privilege, any privilege of confidentiality? And then secondly, is there any cure for that and save the privilege? Okay.
You understood the question.
I hope I did.
Thank you, Dave. Hi. Or William, if the case may be.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is William Fry. I'm a lawyer in Eugene, and I'm not a candidate for any public office. And at the time of the famous Buchanan case, despite what the Oregonian editorial may have said to the contrary, I was not then a candidate for public office, nor did I intend at that time to ever become a candidate for public office. I say that because there's no question in my mind, having followed this particular issue for about 6.5 years and having compiled a substantial file and having discussed this even to the extent of being on national television, that I'm quite aware of the tremendous barrage of publicity that all of you people in the legislature have been subjected to for several months about this issue. And there's little doubt in my mind that the passage of some form of privilege law is inevitable in this session of the legislature. But despite the inevitability of that, I don't want this record to go unchallenged, that is, many of the statements that I've heard here tonight. And I want to, with your indulgence, discuss the number of myths and fantasies that are being perpetuated on the public through the press, and many of which I heard here tonight. I want to discuss with you some of the cases that you've heard about and tell you about the facts of those cases, so that when you get to the point that you are going to draft a bill permitting the broadest type of privilege on a single business or professional group that this state has ever had, or that exists, that would exist any place in the country outside of other similar laws protecting the press, you will at least have the benefit of knowing that there are two sides to this question. And I hope to leave some thoughts with you I hope if this bill is passed, it will not come back someday to haunt you. This is the third time I've appeared before the legislature in opposition to this special interest legislation. Just tonight I was up in Portland at a state bar meeting before I came down here, and I ran into Sam Wilderman. And he reminded me that in 1957 he introduced such a bill. I didn't appear at that time, but I did appear in 1967 and in 1971. And one of the questions that I think that we ought to be asking ourselves is what in the world has happened since 1971 or 1967 that has suddenly made the need for this type of legislation in Oregon necessary? Certainly nothing that any witness has said here before tonight indicates to me that there is any more need for this type of legislation today than there was the first time, the second time, or the third time that the legislature considered this bill. And when a witness would indicate, or several witnesses will indicate, that we are really here in the 1973 session because this is a matter that concerns the public, it's the public that we're interested in, the public's right to know is why we're here, I say that it's quite obvious to me, who has followed this issue very closely and read, I think, all of the literature, all of the cases that I know that exist on this subject, that the real reason why we've got a bill or four bills at this point in this session, and the real reason why we have a room full of persons with a singular point of view is that the press is, in fact, concerned about the fact that some of its members are going to jail or are threatened with going to jail. And so when you are told, if I may submit, that the press really isn't concerned about its people going to jail, I say that that is exactly the reason that we have this type of testimony tonight. What about the people that have gone to jail or that have been threatened with jail? First, and Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to tell these committee members, as you yourself know without my telling you, that I not only am a graduate of the University of Oregon School of Journalism and a present dues-paying member of the Willamette Valley chapter of Sigma Delta Chi, which has been one of the chief protagonists of this type of legislation. I have also represented two newspapers and a radio station. In addition to suing newspapers, I also represent newspapers. So I assume I've got some basis of objectivity. And by the way, Senator Carson, I could have told you what an outtake is.
What is it?
You haven't got the answer to that yet? Well, it's just like the gentleman over here said earlier. all of this that he's filming of me that he doesn't use, he can put in the outtake box. These cases have been mentioned here tonight. The Peter Farr case, which is probably more strongly argued by the supporters of this type of legislation as an example of what can happen to the press in any other case, was the case involving the Los Angeles Examiner reporter who, during the course of the well-publicized Manson case in Los Angeles, despite a court order to the contrary that evidence that information or stories about that particular crime that were not revealed in court should not be printed during the course of the trial in the press. Unfortunately, in my profession, we have some people who are irresponsible, and I suggest that there are irresponsible people who are members of the press. In this case, three lawyers gave this reporter a copy of a statement taken from a witness that was damaging to the defendant in that case, and that was published in the paper by Mr. Farr, contrary to the court's order. When it came time to get that evidence in the court, the judge disallowed it, not because it had been printed in the paper. It just wasn't competent evidence. It was irrelevant evidence. It was prejudicial, but it was there for everybody to see and read. What concerns most lawyers about that situation is this, that despite what the defendant in that case was charged with, despite the great amount of publicity that his exploits had been given, despite what anyone may have thought about him, he was still, at that point, entitled to the benefit of the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution. He was entitled to a trial by an impartial jury. He was entitled to confront the witnesses against him face to face in court. But that constitutional right, I submit, was denied to him by what was printed in the paper on the basis that the reporter had a right or a First Amendment privilege to do so. And when that newspaper reporter failed to reveal to the court the sources, the names of the lawyers that had given him that story, then and only then was he found in contempt and put in jail. And I don't think anyone here, in the same circumstances as that defendant in the criminal case or in any criminal case, would ever feel for one minute that his constitutional rights should be sacrificed upon the altar of a special newsman's privilege. The Peter Bridge case is a case that came out of Newark, New Jersey, where the reporter Peter Bridge reported that a member of the housing authority had been offered a bribe. The district attorney investigated that. He subpoenaed the member of the housing authority who Peter Bridge alleged had been offered a bribe. Her version of the story was entirely different than Mr. Bridge had published in the paper. That rather concerned the district attorney. This certainly was a matter of public interest to the people in Newark. It was a matter of public interest for the people in Newark that Peter Bridge revealed to the grand jury where he got this information that he published in the paper. I submit that the interest of the public in Newark, New Jersey, was not served at all by what Peter Bridge printed in the paper. It might have been served if he had been willing to and had revealed to an investigatory body the source of that information. You're all familiar, I'm sure, with the bombing on the University of Wisconsin campus, where one person was killed and at least two were injured, and the building was substantially destroyed. And within a short time thereafter, there came to a newspaper called the Kaleidoscope, an underground paper in Madison, the persons who claimed that they had committed this crime. And not only did they announce this to this newspaper, but they also said what else they were going to do in the future. The editor of that paper was subpoenaed before the grand jury after the publication of this revelation and refused to reveal the names or the sources of that information. As a result, the citizens of that community were deprived of the necessary tools, or some of the necessary tools that very well could have led to the apprehension and prosecution of the persons responsible for that killing. There has been much talk here tonight about protecting confidential sources, but actually the bill in question does not really protect a confidential source, nor do any of these bills. And I know that the hour is late, and you've probably heard as much as you want to hear tonight, and I want to say, Mr. Chairman, before I overlook the fact that I would offer to come back to this committee at any time and elaborate further. That doesn't mean I'm through right now unless you cut me off, but I want to say that I would come back. As a matter of fact, I'd be happy to even work with this committee on the drafting of a bill. I don't want any bill. I don't think it's necessary, but it's a little bit like the bill that came in the 1955 session when I was a third-year student at the Oregon Law School, and Senator Gill was chairman of the Senate committee, and the press wanted a bill that protected them against libel suits, and so the result of that, the 1955 legislation, was ORS 30.150, which gives to the press of the state of Oregon, as a private business, the only immunity that any private group in this state has for acts of negligence against damages. And I'm talking about the Oregon Retraction Law, and it's true that the press of this state is protected, as is no other group, from its acts of negligence. As a matter of fact, I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that the press of the country today, including the press in the state of Oregon, is better than it's ever been in the history of this country. Not only do we have the statute like the one in Oregon that gives absolute immunity for damages in the event the newspaper publishes a retraction regardless of the degree of negligence, but we also have now, through the kindness of the United States Supreme Court, the one that's been so criticized here tonight, the New York Times rule, which requires that before a person can recover damages for the libel of a public official, a public figure, or on account of the publication of an item of public interest, that that person must prove by clear and convincing evidence what is called in the law actual malice. And unless that party can prove actual malice, no matter how false, no matter how damaging, the New York Times rule protects the press against any damage award. Through the grace of the same United States Supreme Court that I've heard criticized here tonight, the press of this country is able to print and publish ideas to express itself as it has never expressed itself before in the history of this country. And I'm talking about the numerous cases on the subject of obscenity, the numerous cases that deal with the expression of unpopular ideas. And so I'm suggesting that contrary to what I read in the press, what I've heard here tonight, I think the press is in the best condition it's ever been in. What the press is now proposing that this legislature do is grant it a privilege that is enjoyed by no other professional group. Sure, the lawyers have a privilege to keep the communications of their clients confidential, the doctors their patients, the priests their penitents, but every single one of those privileges is subject to being dissolved or set aside by the court. There is no such thing anywhere in the laws of this state or this country that I know of that gives anyone an absolute privilege under any circumstances except the kind of law that's being proposed to this group right now, an absolute privilege law. And no lawyer whose client visits him and tells him that he intends to rob the bank or commit some other crime is entitled to claim a privilege to keep the identity of that client secret from a grand jury or a district attorney. And if that lawyer feels strongly enough about his ethical and moral obligations to that client, then the lawyer's going to go to jail. And lawyers are ready to face that, and I suggest that if the press feels the moral compulsion to keep the secrets of so-called confidential sources, that it ought to be worth the same price that the lawyers would have to pay. I find that there is a substantial inconsistency between the position of the press where it says on the one hand that it is the public's right to know and the public's need to know that we are asking for this type of legislation, and then on the other hand is supporting legislation which in effect closes the mouths of those who could provide information in the public interest. It seems to me that it is better to do something about crime than to write about crime, and I don't think that there is anything commendable about a public policy which would encourage keeping secrets about crime or corruption. As a practical matter, Mr. Chairman, I asked this question in two previous sessions. I haven't heard any responses tonight any different than I've heard before. Where is the example of stories that have gone unpublished in the state of Oregon because we don't have a shield law? Mr. Sullivan, for whom I have great admiration, I've known a number of years, talked about the Pulitzer Prize winners who wrote the stories in the Oregonian during the wild days of District Attorney Langley in Portland. And it's interesting to note that there have been more Pulitzer Prizes awarded in states without Shield laws than in states that did have Shield laws. The story then was published. All the stories that she's been talking about have been published. No story has gone on unpublished because Oregon lacks a Shield law. It's wonderful to want to protect informants. But I haven't heard any testimony here that these informants have stopped talking or the sources are drying up, which is an expression that we see in the paper all the time in support of this type of legislation, at least in her experience, or I assume in the experience of any of the reporters that I've heard here tonight. I listened with interest to Mr. Passman, and as a matter of fact, I would adopt the last half of his statement to this committee as my own argument. He himself has never felt the threat of a subpoena and apparently has never been inhibited in what he wrote about it. He knows of no one else who has either. There's been reference made to the report that was written and published in the University of Michigan Law Review by Professor Blasey, a report that was commissioned by a group of 20 journalists and publishers, and despite the background that led up to the making of that report, Blasey's report indicated that in only 4% of the cases out of 975 responses that he got from reporters, only about 4% were able to say with certainty that they were adversely affected by the threat of a subpoena. And one of the responses came from the Oregon Journal. And Mr. Sterling will probably testify to you, and he'll say that the Oregon Journal has changed its position. Up until now, I think the Oregon Journal was not in favor of any privilege law, but apparently that's changed. But I want to point out that this threat of a subpoena is so infinitesimal when you consider the millions and millions and millions of words and stories that are published in newspapers, on the radio and television in this country every month. The amount of information that comes about through so-called confidential sources that could lead to a court confrontation is infinitesimal. And we don't have any examples here in Oregon that have been that you've been given, but you've been given the examples of these three or four, or shall we say at the most a handful of cases from around the country. And it wasn't until 1958 that anybody ever came up with the bright idea that the First Amendment somehow protected the press. And I would say that I don't know why that argument keeps cropping up, because it's been laid to rest. The Supreme Court, and I would assume, considering counsel in that case, representing the New York Times, as well as the United States government, the state of Kentucky, in the case of Paul Brandsburg, and the state of Massachusetts, that was Pappas, the television cameraman who witnessed civil disobedience and refused to even tell what he saw, that particular case, which is sometimes referred to as the Caldwell case, only Caldwell's name is not in it. His is one of the three cases that the Supreme Court reviewed. But that whole situation, you can believe, was thoroughly briefed and argued in the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court opinion, and it doesn't say this to the contrary in any of the dissenting opinions, but the Supreme Court opinion said that it found nothing to indicate that there was any constriction in the flow of news because of the absence of Shield laws. That was the finding of the United States Supreme Court after lots more debate and perhaps intellectual statements than I'm able to give to you tonight. What I'm saying is, we keep hearing these arguments, we keep hearing the same shibboleths used over and over about how we need this type of legislation, but the fact of the matter is, at least as far as the state of Oregon is concerned, that there hasn't been shown any need. And on the other hand, the committee might consider the consequences that could befall you or anyone else with this type of law on the books. And I think that I gave you one example of the Peter Farr case that arose out of in Los Angeles, But the consequences of you see, this type of law is going to protect the irresponsible just as much and just as thoroughly as the responsible. The possibility of a libel judgment against a judgment proof defendant is no consolation at all. The bill that you want to talk about tonight, and I've read all four, but just taking a look at Senate Bill 206, in addition to the fact that Senator Failey observed that there is no one who prints, writes, shows pictures, or does anything else that wouldn't come under the terms of it, I might also add that I don't know how one would exclude actors or lecturers who certainly provide oral information for communication to the public. And just confining my comments at the moment to that particular bill, it's terribly unrealistically broad, and the whole basis of this, of the so-called need for a privilege bill, rests on the premise that unless we can guarantee confidentiality to our sources, they'll dry up, we won't have the information from them, the public therefore will not know. And if that is true, then this particular bill here goes way beyond that, because this type of bill, and I think all of them for that matter, but particularly Senate Bill 206, does not require a confidential communication in order to be protected under the bill. If you want to take a look, if you want to consider a privilege bill, which is framed in terms of the same theory that underlies all privileges, and that is that there is a certain relationship that must be maintained, and it can only be maintained if you guarantee anonymity and you guarantee confidentiality, then you don't want to write a bill where confidentiality has got nothing to do with it. The man on the street comes up to the chairman and gives him a hot tip on something that's going on in the Oregon State University campus, and he publishes that in the paper. He never asked the chairman to receive that information in confidence. He never extracted any promise from the chairman to keep that in confidence. But yet this bill here would protect every utterance to everybody, whether it was made in confidence or not. And if you're going to get down to a bill, a privilege bill, I would submit respectfully, Mr. Chairman, that you might go back to the basic premise of confidentiality in doing so. Again, if the theory of a privilege bill is to keep a source available, which I say is a myth, because the evidence doesn't indicate that there's any substantial drying up of sources anyway, but if that's the theory of the thing, then when a person is no longer engaged in the publication of news, what reason is there for continuing this privilege with him? Because he's not going to be relying on sources, he's not going to be publishing anything anymore, so why put in the bill that this privilege follows him to his grave? It becomes completely unnecessary as far as supporting confidential sources if the man is no longer engaged in the profession. If I just have a minute or two more, Mr. Chairman, and I'll...
Most of the legislators have been here since 8 this morning, Bill, if you
okay.
Hold it down. I don't want to cut you off because you're the only witness we...
Well, this bill would certainly give Peter Farr a privilege of not revealing the sources of his information.
But that's not the real law. That's not what the lawyers were complaining about. They were complaining that he defied court orders and published the story which prejudiced the jury. And nothing in here would have precluded his union could still endure their contempt of court. Is that right?
Peter Farr.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this bill? No.
Well, this bill speaks to divulging a source of the information, and I thought what you said was that the reporter in that Manson incident had published a story in defiance of a court order. It has nothing to do with the source of the information. The judge just said that he didn't want that story published, and he published it, and therefore it should have been held against the court.
No, he was held in contempt of court because he refused to reveal the source of his news story.
Stated another way, he was not put in jail for what he printed in the paper, even though that was against the order. It wasn't what he printed, it was what he did not print that he was jailed for. I can understand how that impression of the case was received. It was what he didn't print and didn't divulge that he went to jail about. That raises the real question about what kind of mischief this bill passing it will speak to. You've talked about protecting the irresponsible along with the responsible. As far as I know, that's true every time we respect any protect any class of people, so I'm not going to use that as much of an argument. I really am concerned about the question of whether sources dry up or not. And I must say, respectfully, that I don't feel that the survey in the Michigan Law Review is too relevant to me in Oregon. Whether the people said that they weren't intimidated or that a small percentage of them were intimidated by it. I'd like to get down to cases, and I hope this will not be disagreeable with you. The Buchanan case has already been mentioned. What I'm interested in is whether the information that there was widespread use or relatively widespread use of an illegal drug would have become publicly known if reporters such as Annette Buchanan knew they might have to disclose their source or go to jail. In other words, do you see the possibility of that kind of situation producing silence on a subject where the reporter had special knowledge and where the society at large could be informed, namely if there was widespread use of a drug? Do you see that as possible?
Yeah.
I suppose your response is that wouldn't happen in that case because you printed the story.
Well, of course, it was inevitable that would become known. Remembering, of course, that in the context of the time, everybody naively thought that in Eugene, Oregon, there wasn't too much of this going on.
I guess that's just my point. They found out they were wrong by reason of the story. Had she known she was going to go to jail, would she have printed?
Well, I don't know of any reporter who has failed to print something because he thought that he might face jail. That's one of the questions I keep asking.
I don't want to cut you off, but I don't have any more questions.
I'm not familiar with the kaleidoscope incident, but in that situation, when the reporter refused to divulge a prison case, did he also refuse to divulge the events that were happening in the future, the excessive events, or did he really have time to do what he was doing?
Well, that was in the story that was published. The story that was published in the paper.
So in that instance,
Right.
Are there any more questions? Bella, as I said, I do not want to cut you off because I've been here a long time.
Well, I realize that.
Morning, and if you, I think we'll probably have Don Sterling of the Portland Journal, Oregon Journal. Excuse me, Don. Sorry, the TV cameras are left on, I know.
I'm here, to shorten it up a bit, to speak in favor of Senate Bill 206. And I'll gladly adopt, without repeating it, the philosophical and most of the factual arguments that have been made in support of Senate Bill 206. So if I may, I'd like to address myself mainly to some of the questions that various members of this committee have raised and that previous witnesses have raised that I think haven't been answered and perhaps would be a little bit fresh. And in case it's necessary to set the stage, I know there are a number of attorneys on this committee, and you can read the libel laws for yourself. But I must say that as a
what I like to regard as a working newspaper man and editor of the Oregon Journal. My understanding of the Oregon libel law is not the one that's been given here tonight. In the first place, the Oregon libel law is written in such a way as to ensure a retraction when a falsehood has been published. In the second place, it does not protect the newsman from paying damages, money damages, for false and malicious statements. It does protect us. It mitigates what are called general damages, and I don't have to educate most of you on what the general damage is. As I understand it, as a layman, that means the damage that you're, the amount the court requires you to pay just to punish you for having done the bad thing that you did. That is mitigated by publishing a timely retraction of a piece of libel. It does not in any way protect you from paying any actual damages. As I understand it, what they call special damages, if it can be shown that a publication was false and libelous and it actually injured someone, the newspaper is required, the broadcaster is required to pay damages to the extent that he damaged somebody. And I think that's perfectly proper. But I think there is a misunderstanding abroad on this subject, and if the question is there a law to make the press be responsible, there is a law to make the press be responsible. And if I'm wrong about that, then the newspaper I work for is paying very large sums every month to a law firm to tell us what to do about the claims for damages in libel that we do receive and we do act on. So much for that. Mr. Fry has asked you quite properly, what has changed in the last few years to make it desirable perhaps now to have this law when previous legislatures did not provide it? Well, let me point out one thing. That in 1968, for the first time, the Oregon Supreme Court took this very question under consideration in the Buchanan case. Prior to that, I believe it was quite widely believed in the press and in the general public that the freedom of the press and freedom of speech provisions of the Oregon Constitution and the federal Constitution did, in general, provide for the kind of confidentiality that we're talking about tonight. In 1968, for the first time, that something new happened. The Oregon Supreme Court in the Buchanan case said, no, it's not just plain there in the first, in the Oregon or federal freedom of press section. The Oregon Supreme Court, on the other hand, said, however, if you wish to provide this kind of protection as it has been provided for about nine other classes of Oregon citizens, the legislature is at liberty to write such a law. And that's what we're here to try to do, if anyone wants to do it. What else has changed? Well, it was only last June in the Caldwell case and the others that you've been hearing about that the United States Supreme Court said exactly the same thing, that it ain't there in the First Amendment, but if the legislature wants to provide it, it can do so. And that is the process that we're engaged in. What else has changed? Well, I don't have to tell people like you that the climate of the country has changed. We've had in the late 60s and the early 70s the turbulence of the dissenting movement. And what I want to talk to you mostly about is the way life is as opposed to legal theory. The police and prosecutors have turned to the press as they did not used to do and have asked the press for information that the press has gathered, asked them for photographs that they've taken, because there is a growing division between some of the dissenters in this country and law enforcement on the other hand. And the press, in some ways, had better access to these groups than the established law enforcement officers did. So the law enforcement officers took the step of trying to make the press an arm of law enforcement and subpoenaing their information. Now, I would hope that in nothing that has been said tonight is there any implication that the press does not intend to cooperate with law enforcement. I think that if this law passed, you would have exactly what you've got now, which is a very close cooperation between most parts of the press and most of the law enforcement officers most of the time. And again, I simply ask you to call in your experience as people of the world to know that that is the case. But you know, for example, that there are laws in this country against impersonating a law enforcement officer. There aren't any laws against impersonating a newsman. But the law enforcement officers have been doing that as one device, that's true, as one device for penetrating the cover of some of these groups which they felt they had to penetrate. The ability of the press, therefore, to report what's going on has been compromised. That's something else that has changed. And the clearest case history of it is in this Caldwell decision, which is involved in
our discussions tonight, where Earl Caldwell, a black reporter for the New York Times, was able to talk to some Black Panthers in the San Francisco Bay Area, and was thereafter called before a grand jury down there and asked to tell some details of what he had found out from the Panthers that the law enforcement people hadn't been able to find. Well, we didn't used to have that kind of thing go on. Now, I happen to believe that newspaper men are first of all citizens, and we do have an obligation to cooperate with law enforcement. But like most of these things, there is no such thing as an absolute privilege. There certainly is no such thing as an absolute freedom of the press or of speech. We all know about you can't cry fire in a crowded theater. I hope, very sensitive to the Sixth Amendment right of fair trial. But I have to say, if the First Amendment right of free speech and freedom of the press is to some degree qualified, then possibly the Sixth Amendment right to fair trial at least may not be perfectly unqualified, though I certainly think it should be as unqualified as possible. And to go to one of the questions that Senator Fadley asked, there is an instance which was given me by a circuit judge, and I have to, I'll leave it to you, the lawyers, whether it's true. There is recognized in the law, and not by blessing of any statute, the right to keep police informers' identities secret. And this in direct contravention of the Sixth Amendment guarantee of the right to confront your accusers. I believe that this is a right created for law enforcement officers by decisions of the Supreme Court, and I've read a case on it, which was very recently handed down by the Oregon Supreme Court, which quoted from this privilege, that in getting a search warrant, the police officer did not have to reveal who it was that told him that there was narcotics in the house.
What that proves is that you don't have to tell a person's name in order to honestly rely on what he said. Questions
honestly lie. Precisely. And that is what we're saying, that when you're a reporter, you don't have to tell the person's name in order to rely on what he says, provided you remain responsible for the authenticity of what you said. Now, nothing that I know of that any of these newsmen are talking about is any kind of a license for being false, malicious, or irresponsible in any way. We're responsible for every darn thing we print. And we can be sued for it. We can be flung in jail for it. For criminal libel, I guess. And we're not asking for anything different. What we are asking for, exactly what you're saying, the right to judge our sources, and if we, as the law enforcement officers do, if they feel that they've got a reliable source and the court's willing to accept their word for it, then perhaps in limited cases, maybe we need the same right. Okay. Now, Mr. Fry also alluded to the fact that the Journal changed its position. I'm a convert, gentlemen. I wrote an editorial. And the Journal took the editorial position. The last time this was up in 67, we were against this legislation. But for a special reason that probably the subtleties of the editorial mind don't get across. I am very concerned about making this what it really is, a guarantee of rights to the public and not to any special class. I respectfully disagree with Senator Bowe when he says the press is special. I think what we've got to do here is write a bill, and I believe the 206 is a pretty good bill, which can be relied upon by any citizen. That's what we're after. The First Amendment was written for the benefit of every citizen, not the guy who's got a big press in his basement. And the reason that we were opposed, and perhaps this answers Mr. Fry's question about whether we've changed our position, I've changed my position, I only speak for myself, is that the previous bill spoke of people who were engaged in the work of gathering news. And to me, that sounded pretty much like somebody who was on somebody else's payroll, and I'm against having that kind of a qualification. Because it leads to the most dangerous kind of abridgment of civil liberties that there can be, and that is a licensed press. If you write this law, and I'm amazed at some of the laws that I see here, if you write it to say that you can't qualify unless you work for a newspaper, as Mr. Davis quoted earlier, that's been in publication for a year, then it has a circulation of so much, and it's in some of these bills, what you're doing is really saying who's entitled to practice the dissemination of information and who isn't. And that is the most direct abrogation of the First Amendment I can think of, since the freedom of the press was written for the benefit of this occasional pamphleteer, if you wish. We've all got this right, and that's why we opposed the earlier bill. And when I became satisfied that the bill was written in such a way that it would apply to the dissenter, to the guy I don't like, the guy I don't agree with, the guy I don't trust, as well as the good guys like me, then I became able to support it. Next point.
May I say something to you on that point?